This episode is brought to you by Curie Briefs, the smartest 3-minute read in medicine. Think of it like mental floss for busy clinicians. Sharp, concise, and clinically relevant. Check it out today at Curie.md. And now, on to the show.
Today on Curie, we're joined by Dr. Adam Rosen, an orthopedic surgeon with over 2 decades of experience. But his story isn't just about the operating room or the 300-plus joint replacements he performs each year. Dr. Rosen recently published a candid memoir titled OR Confidential, Confessions of a Gen X Surgeon, where he pulls back the curtain on surgical life, the stress, the mistakes, the victories, and the toll it all takes on a physician's mental health. Beyond the book, you might know Dr. Adam Rosen from his podcast, Your Knee, Your Health, or his YouTube channel, at Dr. Adam Rosen, where he makes orthopedic medicine accessible and empowering for patients. In our conversation, we dive into what it means to be a Gen X physician, how burnout creeps in even for the most seasoned doctors, the early warning signs clinicians should watch for, and how Dr. Rosen's own mental health journey reshaped the way he practices medicine. Honest, raw, and not the side of medicine you usually hear, here's Dr. Adam Rosen. Dr. Adam Rosen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Super excited to have you on. And I want to start with your recently published book. And I actually want to start with the title, OR Confidential. So you obviously chose to make the operating room your home base. And you decided to specialize not just in any surgeries, but hips and knees, you know, the joints that enable people to walk, to run, to dance. When did you first know that the operating room and orthopedics was going to be your calling?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's part, the book for me was sort of an idea that I had for a while, but it kind of morphed into what it became. So I really introduced a lot of my history in part one of sort of the memoirs of how I got to where I was. And a lot of people were kind of surprised to hear that I really thought becoming an orthopedic surgeon meant that you got to wear pajamas to work and play with plaster of Paris. Like, I just thought that was the coolest thing because I broke a lot of bones as a young kid. But as I grew older, I started doing a lot of building, a lot of odd jobs, made decks and additions and built climbing walls. So I was really comfortable with building things and working with power tools. And then for me, sort of the defining moment was when I was in college volunteering in an emergency room. And I had the experience, because they knew I wanted to go into ortho, I always tended to help out the ortho docs when they were coming in to take care of patients. But one day I had the opportunity to go up and scrub in on a hip fracture surgery. And for me, that was just like an eye-opening experience. Like, you know, here's this crazy sterile room with all of these tools that I had used, but they were all stainless steel and sterile, and using screwdrivers and plates and screws to put a hip fracture back together. And for me, that was the defining moment of, this is definitely what I wanted to do. I couldn't see doing anything other than orthopedic surgery at that point.
So while the title of your book is OR Confidential, the subtitle of your book is then Confessions of a Gen X Surgeon. And I imagine that qualifier is very intentional. So what about being Gen X shaped your experience as an orthopedic surgeon? And how was that experience maybe different from some of the generations before or after you?
I think right now I'm sort of in that middle of the road, you know, middle of the road career age for a doctor. And when I've had the opportunity to lecture to groups of doctors about burnout and about physician suicide and depression, I really kind of preface it by saying that most of the older docs that are in the audience, you know, the 60, 65 and older, 70 plus, this discussion really doesn't typically pertain to them because of all the stresses that we deal with. I mean, financially, unless they made really stupid decisions, they should be financially secure. You know, most of their children should be older and independent. Their mortgages should be paid off. Their retirement funds should be fully funded. And most of them are probably already working part-time and working because they want to, not because they have to. So all of the stresses that you might have in a younger part of the career are not going to be there. The bigger issue, I think, is, you know, my generation, and then we're seeing it even in the younger generation of doctors coming out. When I trained, it was right when that 80-hour work week shifted, and I found that many people my age, there's just that overachiever, which you see in a lot of professions, especially in healthcare, but you couldn't go home early. I mean, working 36 hours was not uncommon. Leaving early, asking to go to sleep, to go to the call room, to get a nap was shown as a sign of weakness. And you just push through. And you can do that for so long. And I think there are some lucky people that can do that for decades throughout their career. I mean, you see this in trauma surgeons that just are operating, you know, all night long and running clinics the whole next day. But for most of us, that's tiring. It's exhausting. And I think it was good having the 80-hour work week, but, and I don't know, and I'm not an expert on anxiety and depression. You hear about all these studies about how social media plays into it, but I think we're even seeing these younger generations of doctors coming out of medical school with issues with anxiety and depression that begin in, you know, elementary school, intermediate school, high school, college. You know, then you hit medical school, which is hard enough as it is, and then you're coming in. So I think I wanted people to sort of understand where I was coming from. So younger generations might see how someone slightly older than them is dealing with it, but also so older docs aren't reading it and saying, oh, I don't know what this guy's talking about. I don't have any of these problems. You know, it's definitely generational, and I think more often we're seeing these problems arise at a young age, and it's just being propagated and worsened because the training and the time to be a doctor is difficult enough as it is, not without all of the other things that are happening in our world and our society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually want to dive a little bit deeper into some of these personal anecdotes and some of the specific motifs within the book. I know early on you write about kind of this perfect storm of all sorts of things happening, hitting at once, you know, a lawsuit, you know, supply chain chaos, administrative burden, issues with EMR systems, et cetera, that kind of felt you left you feeling completely drained. And I think the part that stands out to me is actually the moment in which you decided to get help. And I think for a lot of physicians, asking for help comes with a heavy layer of stigma, you know, about fear, about, you know, what your colleagues are going to think, or fear about, you know, your licensing boards, or even, you know, issues with kind of your own self-image. So I was wondering if you could kind of take us into that moment in which you decided, hey, I feel like I'm reaching a breaking point. I can't keep going like this. And how did you overcome that fear and that stigma that keeps so many physicians from getting help?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And like you kind of alluded, it's not a simple answer, because I was definitely struggling for a while and just feeling that, you know, every task, whether or not it was at work or at home, just became harder and harder to do. And the joy of life, sort of that happiness feeling, was just gone. And it just felt as if every day was just a struggle. And when I noticed that I was starting to have more and more of these problems and the difficulty sleeping and the difficulty concentrating. And I would never classify myself as an alcoholic, but I definitely found I would self-medicate with a glass or two of wine or a beer or two every night simply to try to get my brain to turn off, to try to get some sleep. It just became this horrible, vicious cycle. And I realized that everything that I was trying to do was not working. But the thing that I talk about and the thing that I write about, though, is like you said, I mean, I had to admit there was a problem. That's sort of number one. It's hard for a lot of us to admit that there's an issue, that we can't handle it. and then asking for help. And it's, you know, unfortunately not as simple as, hey, I need help. And then, oh my God, here's help. It for me was a struggle of where do you go? I mean, right, you Google therapists and you get a billion answers. And even within our institution, they had a group of people that were there to assist, but it wasn't as simple as here's a name, call them. It was sort of here's a list, good luck. And then it was the difficulties that a lot of patients deal with any aspect of healthcare is who's available, who's accepting new patients, who's retired, who moved out of town, who accepts your insurance, what's the copay going to be, are you going to get approved? And it was really, really hard. I almost gave up, you know, a few times, but, you know, I was really glad that I kept pushing because deep down I knew there was an issue, and I was really, you know, lucky to find the therapist that I've been working with this whole time because she's been instrumental in really getting me through a super difficult period. But yeah, I think that is the thing in our world, and you know, in a lot of other professions, there is that stigma of mental health, and that's one of the reasons that it was very difficult to decide to kind of be this open. And every time I talk about it, it gets easier. But that was that stigma, because if I had a heart attack and was in the ER and had a stent put in and was put on Plavix, like it would be really simple to go back in and tell everybody, oh yeah, I was out for a few weeks because I had a heart attack and I'm in cardiac rehab and I had a stent. And nobody, patient or doctor, would bat an eye. But as soon as you take time off of work because of a mental illness, there's still that stigma in our society. And like you alluded to earlier too, there is that fear of what does that do to my license? And a lot of groups are trying to get that question off of the state applications when you apply for your medical license, because people are afraid to get help because they're afraid about how they're going to answer the question. And we all know that if you're depressed, you're more likely to make medical errors. So it almost behooves people to make that ability to get care and seek out care easier to prevent problems, not only in the person themselves, but in the hundreds and thousands of patients' lives that they interact with on a daily basis. So for me, that's the one thing I tell everybody is that, you know, you have to admit there's a problem first. And then once you do, you have to do a lot to seek out care. I think luckily for people that work in the healthcare field, they do know how to navigate the system a little bit better than patients that don't work in the field. And even knowing that, it was still hard and difficult for me. So I can barely imagine what it would be like for someone without a medical degree or background to try to navigate the system and get in to find help when they need it.
I know after you had spoken up about your own experience, you had remarked on the number of colleagues that came up to you privately and, you know, pulled you aside and wanted to share their own struggles in a similar way. And I thought that was so reflective of actually where the culture still is in terms of secrecy and fear. So I wanted to ask if you had any thoughts on how organizations, hospitals, clinics, practice owners, how can they create an environment where people feel comfortable having these conversations out loud without fear?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I don't know that there's a simple solution, but I do believe that allowing people to discuss these things and make them feel more normal and accepted is the best place to start. I've even brought up to a few people at different places that when we do our regular M&M, you know, it becomes very rote and you're taught in medical school. Like you get up, you present the patient, the procedure, the complication, the data that supports what the studies are and how we treated it and what the outcome was. And it's very robotic. And we're in a profession where empathy is really important, but we're also taught very frequently how to turn off emotion. So I've always thought that it would be really important at M&M meetings, especially for older doctors, for younger doctors that are in the audience, to then also expand on, this is how it made me feel. I lost sleep for so many days. You know, I scrutinized the literature because I was afraid I made a mistake. I've changed how I practice now going forward. Like this is how it affected me mentally and physically and personally. To let younger doctors know that, you know, even the older doctors still are human and they still struggle. And I think then younger doctors can deal with the stresses of our job without feeling guilty for feeling like they're weak, or being afraid to discuss how something like that made them feel. But it is true. I mean, and that's always been my sort of MO. When I even first wrote my knee book about arthritis, like my goal was like, hey, I want to put all my knowledge in a book that one person somewhere in the world can read and learn something from it. And the same thing with all my YouTube videos. And that was my goal with this book, you know, was hoping that one other person out there felt less alone, felt validated, felt that they weren't struggling in silence. And I can't tell you, like, I've lost count now, the number of people that have, you know, called me or messaged me, even like in our medical group, you know, doctors, we've gotten so big, I think, in healthcare that frequently now you don't interface face to face with a lot of doctors like we used to when we were smaller. And, you know, having people text me and call me or, you know, run into them walking out to the parking garage and saying, hey, look, that hit home with everything you wrote is everything I'm dealing with, everything I'm feeling. Like, and Lenny, they'll say over and over again, I really thought I was the only one. I thought I was the only one that was dealing with this. I thought I was the only one that couldn't handle this. And it was so nice to see that someone else kind of laid it out there. So that's always been my goal. And as hard as it was in the beginning to talk about it, I wouldn't say it's easy, but every single time I talk about it, personally for me, it gets easier and easier. And I feel validated every single time I talk about it. When someone says, oh my God, I feel the same way, it makes me too feel, wow, okay, here's another person that's dealing with what I dealt with. So I really wasn't the only one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually want to park on that topic for a little bit, around support system, because I also know in your story, you know, your wife and your therapist are central characters in your recovery. Can you kind of just speak to the importance of, you know, having family, having peers, having mentors as part of your support system, and the importance of having or viewing this recovery process kind of as a team sport rather than an individual one?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine how somebody would go about doing this, you know, by themselves. You know, and I've mentioned that and talked about that too. I think if I was single, that, you know, I probably would have wound up in a psych institution, and who knows what sort of help and support I would have gotten after that and where I would be today. I don't remember much of like those first like 6 or 8 weeks. So there's really large parts of it that are a blur, but I do mention it. And I remember really vividly, you know, my therapist, it was just this look that's stuck with me ever since, that when my wife took me there, just the look on her face at how sick I must have looked and how weak and sort of decrepit I looked in the state that I was in, compared to what she was so used to, and just having, you know, weekly discussions and talking about stress of life and work, you know, that really hit home for me. And, you know, my wife was sort of the advocate. And even now she says, you know, she didn't really know what to do. I mean, it was new for her as well as for me, you know, and we had kids and a house, and it was all this stuff that had to get taken care of. And all of a sudden I became sort of the issue. And I remember she had told me that she had called up our nursing manager, who I'd known for years, because she was my nurse for a number of years. And she just called her up and said, you know, hey, Adam's not coming in. And she's like, what do you mean? Like, on Monday, and when is he going to be back? She's like, I have no idea. And that was sort of how work found out. It was just basically my wife calling on a weekend and going like, he's not coming back. And it was up in the air. And for me now, for the longest time, and I think a lot of young doctors, because even the young surgeons that we train, they feel this all the time. Like, when you start working, you have to be at work. I mean, how many doctors show up sick because I have a full clinic, I have a full operating room schedule. You can't take a day off. There are no substitute teachers in healthcare. So you just keep working and working and working. And what was amazing is I have great partners that I didn't show up and they took over. You know, they saw all my post-op patients, they rearranged my surgical schedule, they offered all the patients surgeries with my partners so they could keep their same surgical dates. And it's the good and the bad. You know, it's the other thing I tell people, like, hey, look, if you can't do the job, just realize, like, if you don't show up tomorrow, someone's going to take that spot. Like, work is going to keep on going. Mm-hmm. But so many times, I think we create this story in our head that work can't survive without me. And then we wind up putting our own health and well-being second. And sometimes you do have to kind of take that step back. But yeah, for me, that was the hardest part. And I think my wife, I mean, she was, when I was in therapy, I mean, she was driving me to therapy and picking me up from therapy. It was like a kid going to school. I was really unable to care for myself. So without someone there to drive me to and from therapy, I don't know how I would have gotten there. You know, without someone to make sure that I was eating, I don't know how I would have kind of got through all that. So, you know, I really feel terrible for the people that don't have that support, you know, and it really begs the issue where we have such a huge homeless population and so many of them have mental health issues that they just didn't have support. You know, in San Diego, it's a huge military town, and that's where in the program that I was in, I mean, there were a lot of people in healthcare, but there were a lot of people in the military, you know, so we have two huge industries here and both are struggling with mental health issues. And not everybody has access to care or the ability to get the care that they really deserve.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, after you came through that crisis, what was the impact on your approach to patient care? And I know educating patients is such a big part of your work and your story, particularly through your YouTube channel. So I wanted to ask, did your own mental health journey kind of shift the way in which you talk or the way in which you connect with patients?
Definitely. And you know, to be completely honest and be human, you know, in our world, it's really unique that you can see 20, 30, 40 individuals on a regular day, all different with different problems. And sometimes it's easy, you know, like in anywhere in the world, sometimes it's easy to bond with a person. And there's other people that just, for whatever reason, kind of rub you the wrong way. The cat's joining us. and what I found, though, is over 20 years, I definitely became more of a colder, less empathic surgeon. And I think it was the system that brought me down. So looking back, there was definitely a number of years leading up to this where I just wasn't very nice. And that's what I've said now, because returning to work still is in flux for me. You know, the hard part was, would I be able to get back to work? And then once I decided that I thought I could, how do I go about doing it? You know, and I entered back very slowly part-time in the office with this plan, this master plan, that I would just ramp back up to what I was doing before all of this. And that hasn't played out. And I have really kind of come to the conclusion that I don't think I have the physical, mental capacity to work at the level that I was working at before. And I wanted to get back to the operating room in a lot of ways. And I've come to the realization that I just don't think I'm going to be able and capable of doing it. So it's changed the way that I practice. And what's interesting is I find now that I think I doctor better, and I don't profile patients. Many surgeons, I think, profile patients, and they look at them as, you're surgical or not surgical. And if you're not surgical, my goal is to get you out of the office as quickly as possible because you can't fill an operating room schedule. And you hear this from patients, you know, the surgeon told me he can't help me because I don't need an operation, or come back when I want surgery. And I think a lot of times we forget that we were doctors first. And what I have found now is that because I've decided to see less patients, and this is what you talked about, you know, in your podcast episode on happiness, a lot of the doctors talked about, you know, making less money and working less and being happier. And I'm seeing less patients and I'm working less days. But I like to believe that I'm happier. But I also like to believe that I have the time to sit and educate my patients. Because my schedule is not so packed, I'm not rushed into the next room and feeling like I'm getting behind. And I can answer all the questions. And patients are leaving happier, like verbally saying, I can't believe how much time you spent with me today. Thank you so much. You answered all of my questions. I feel so much better. And all patients should, I think, leave the doctor's office with that feeling and that attitude. And more often than not, we see patients that feel like they were rushed. You know, the doctor spent 2 minutes with me, yet they had this, you know, 8-page note in the electronic medical record, and or maybe I saw their physician assistant or nurse practitioner for 5 minutes, but I only got to, you know, say hi to the doctor for a second. And I can, even the patients that don't need surgery, give them a plan and answer all their questions. And even in the subspecialty world, I was guilty of it. And even my staff was guilty of it years ago. You know, somebody would have, oh, can you look at my shoulder too? No, this doctor only does knees. You know, and then we're making a patient make another appointment with another doctor and have another copay. And, you know, I'm a board certified orthopedic surgeon. And now I see people for their plantar fasciitis and their shoulder pain and their neck pain. And I can work it up, see them back, take care of them. And if they need a surgery, then I get to fast track them to one of my partners. And my partners know that I've done the workup, I've done the non-op care, and it basically vetted that this patient is sort of teed up for surgery. And it's actually helped, you know, our department that way, because I'm able to fill up my partner schedules that are operating, but I'm also able to absorb all the non-op patients. And I feel better at the end of the day. Like, I really feel that at the end of each day that I've helped people. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that I think was important for me to gain back. For many years leading up to this, I always used to say that I love what I do, but I hated my job. Like, I loved being in the room with a patient face to face, or I loved doing the surgery, but everything else that was involved in healthcare, I just hated, which is what I hear from a lot of people nowadays. It's not that they really hate taking care of individual people. It's just all the other minutiae that we're stuck doing on a daily basis just to get through the day.
Yeah, I would actually love to dive into that topic a little bit further, because I think in the book you make it very clear that burnout isn't about, you know, individual toughness or individual willpower. It's more so a product of our systems, you know, massive staffing shortages, endless administrative work, you know, paperwork, mountains of paper stacking up, and all of these productivity metrics that are used to evaluate individual physicians. I wanted to ask, you know, if there are some policy changes that you had in mind, if you could kind of just wave a policy magic wand, what are some of the systemic changes that you'd like to address to reduce burnout and reduce some of these challenges with the U.S. healthcare system?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's hard, right? And that's where I always admit, like, I don't know what the answers are. I think it's so complicated. It'd be great if there was one thing. I think, you know, one simple thing, maybe if you broke it down into the different subsets. I mean, there's a billion things wrong with insurance companies and healthcare in America. I just read an article just the other day about an older couple. They'd been married for like more than 50 years. And the husband was medically ill, was racking up a huge amount of debt, and they got divorced, put the house in the wife's name, you know, basically gave her all of his finances. They still live together and they're still married. But this way, when he dies and declares bankruptcy, she is not stuck with his bills. You know, and that says a lot about our healthcare system. You know, for someone to be able to do that really shows that the system is a mess. You know, if you look at all the metrics, right, like the growth of physicians, pretty flat. You know, the reimbursement goes the opposite direction. But you look at the growth of healthcare administrators, huge. Each one of those is a salary that has to be paid from the healthcare industry. And then you look at the growth of people in the healthcare sector, whether or not in the hospital or the insurance companies, that are reviewing all of these requests for orders, tests, and surgeries and medications. And again, each of those people is a salary. So at the same time, we have seen an increase in everybody's health insurance rates, an increase in many people's deductibles, an increase in copays. At the same time, physician reimbursement continues to go down. So it should be simple for someone to say, hey, where's all the money going? Well, it's going to all these administrators and healthcare insurance companies. But I think the biggest thing for doctors is you go to medical school, you go through residency, you create a practice of lifelong learning and continuing medical education. You see a patient, a human interaction, you evaluate them, diagnose them, and you decide what is best to care for them. And then someone without a medical degree says, no, it's denied. It's not approved. You need to do a peer-to-peer review. And the simplest thing, I think, is if you eliminated those things, one, you could cut a huge amount of cost because you don't have people scrutinizing every order and test. Doctors feel better because they're able to get the care for their patients they feel their patients deserve. Doctors have more time because they're not doing peer-to-peer reviews. And then patients are happier and potentially get better care more efficiently. Now, I agree, there's doctors out there that definitely abuse tests, but the computer models are well enough to say, hey, if everyone orders X amount of tests and this doctor in this town is ordering 10 times X, great, scrutinize that doctor. But you don't need to go after all doctors and all patients, charge them buku bucks, and then deny care. You know, I still get patients where, you know, their deductibles are so high, they'll pay cash for an MRI in town, which runs about $400, because their deductible might be so high, and with their insurance contract, it would actually be more out of pocket to use their insurance. And you hear this with medications all the time. Yeah, but the other thing is the electronic medical record, right? And there's no simple way. I don't think we're ever going to get rid of it, but it's definitely not user-friendly. I mean, anybody that's kind of dabbled in it, I mean, the amount of click fatigue to kind of jump through hoops is just such a huge time waste during the day. And then messaging has gone up astronomically. And that's where I agree. Like, messaging's great because if I have a patient who I order a test, like I'll order a vitamin D level, someone had a fragility fracture, and I tell them, hey, you know, we're going to check. And if it's really low, I'm going to put you on a prescription. And if it's, you know, in the middle, just continue your supplements. And I can send a message back in 30 seconds, like, your vitamin D level was great, continue what you're doing. I think messaging is great for that. You know, or late at night, patient, you know, wants to send a message of, hey, can someone call me to set up an appointment for a cortisone injection? Like, pretty benign sort of stuff. But the patients that abuse that system, and I really applaud the systems that are now charging patients for electronic medical messaging, but because we're obligated to do that, we're caring for a human being, there really should be some RVU generation or flat rate or some reimbursement. You know, every lawyer, you know, you spend 10 minutes on the phone, that bill goes onto your bill. But yet doctors can sit in their office for hours at the beginning or the end of the day responding to all of these messages and clicking all these buttons and checking all these x-rays. And it's essentially for free. And then you get hospital administrators that are kind of like, well, yeah, you know, you signed up for this. This is part of the job. Like, no. It wasn't part of the job. It wasn't part of the job until the government and healthcare industry introduced the EMR. Then it became part of the job, but it wasn't something that someone expected. And that's where, like, when I was researching my book, it was scary, the statistics of how medical school students already feel that the electronic medical record is going to be such a burden on their careers. And they're not even in the hospitals yet doing that on a regular basis. So the EMR definitely has to change to become less complicated, more time efficient, and reimbursable. And I think that becomes a huge thing that could make doctors feel less burned out, have better job satisfaction. And then I think the administrative burden too, I think too often, and you see this in any profession, you get someone that's hired as a manager, but they've never worked in the trenches. And there might be the rare manager that does come in and says, I have this great idea and it really is better than what we do here. But more often than not, you see people without a medical degree coming in and telling people, doctors and nurses, how they're going to do things now. They've never worked in the trenches. They don't know how this system is different from that system. They don't know what has been tried already over the past few years and failed. And then you get a lot of animosity because people feel like, hey, you're changing the system. It was pretty efficient, even though it wasn't great. We had ideas that would have made it better, and we got stonewalled. And now you implicate this, you know, new process, and it's actually just made our jobs harder and more difficult. And I'd say probably that would be like the top three. I think it's probably the biggest three burdens I hear about, you know, from other doctors and other nurses. And if you could make sort of those changes, it would make a minor improvement, I think, in the well-being of people working in the healthcare field.
Yeah. You know, speaking of burnout
and administrative burden. I know how important meditation and mindfulness practices have fit into your recovery strategy and some of the tactics that you use to combat, you know, feelings of burnout. And if my research is correct, I know that you're a certified mindfulness teacher, which mm-hmm. isn't something yeah. you often see in a, you know, surgeon's bio.
Right.
So I wanted to talk a little bit more about that. You know, how did this come about? What was kind of the motivation for you to become a mindfulness teacher? And then, you know, maybe if you had to speak to some of your physician colleagues, obviously, you know, they're crunched on time. They really don't have much time to maybe incorporate mindfulness and incorporate meditation practices into their day. So do you have any advice for them in terms of what is a realistic starting point on how they might be able to bake this into their day-to-day routine?
Yeah, the nice thing there is that nowadays there are so many options. And, you know, you can get very sort of religious oriented meditation and very secular, you know, meditation options. For me, you know, a lot of it was tied into Tibetan Buddhism. So, you know, I had a lot of teaching through that. And then the app Calm, which is a great resource for people because it's a great app that has more than just mindfulness meditation and guided meditations. So for someone that was like, I don't know where to go, it's an app that has tons of information. The other thing, which is nice, there's a Tibetan Buddhist monk named Mingyur Rinpoche, and he has a foundation called Turgar. And they offer a lot of Tibetan Buddhist teaching programs, but they offer a pretty secular meditation program called The Joy of Living. And one of the things that he always talks about is this idea of short times, many times. So many people, when they think about meditation, very frequently just assume it's, you know, sitting on a cushion for 20 or 30 minutes a day. And that is a big part of the practice if you're practicing regularly. But the idea of mindfulness and mindfulness meditation and daily practice can be utilized all throughout the day. So his idea of short times, many times is, you know, if you're brushing your teeth, is really brushing your teeth and not brushing your teeth and scrolling on your phone or thinking about what you have to do or walking around and picking up your clothes. And, you know, mindfulness of eating, you know, so often we're scrolling our phones or reading a book and maybe even having a conversation. But very frequently do people actually taste and chew and savor the food or what they're drinking. Walking is one of those simple things. They even teach people, like, even if you're in clinic and you're walking to the next room, like, you can be mindful of five steps between room to room. And it's as simple as sometimes taking a deep breath. Like, I always jokingly say there's deep breath patients and double deep breath patients, because sometimes you see a patient on the clinic and you just know they're a difficult patient and you take that deep breath before you open the door and walk in. And there's other patients where it's difficult when you're in the room and you walk out and you get into the hallway and you take a deep breath. And there's some patients that you do the deep breath before and after, but sometimes just taking a deep, slow breath before you're going to do something is that, you know, 10-second, 5-second reset of where am I, how am I feeling, what's going on inside my body and my brain. And those little bits throughout the day can help reset the brain. And, you know, from a science aspect, I think for a lot of those that are in science in the medical field, Dave Richardson and Kurt Dahl, who are at University of Wisconsin-Madison, have a program called the Healthy Minds Initiative, which is a free app about mindfulness. But what's interesting is everything is very short. Everything is a walking meditation. You can pick it for 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 7 minutes, or a sitting meditation or an exercise meditation. But then interspersed is the science behind what they're finding through fMRIs and how the brain actually works and what mindfulness does to the brain and how activities can affect our feelings and physiology. So for people that are very science oriented, it's a nice sort of balance of, hey, this is the science behind why and how it works and what it's doing to you. And then here's very short, brief things that you can just add in during the day to start on that sort of mindfulness journey.
Mm-hmm. I want to look ahead and ask if you have any advice to young clinicians that might be listening to this episode, you know, a whole new generation coming into medicine right now. You know, you have your Gen Zs that are probably, you know, finishing up med school, millennials maybe finishing up residency. So a whole new wave of doctors coming in. You talked about how some of them are already maybe aware of some of these potential triggers for burnout and some of the challenges to EMRs. But what advice would you give to some of our younger listeners about, you know, maybe being able to preserve their compassion, especially as they look towards, you know, a 30-year plus career that's all in front of them?
Yeah, there's so many things that I think are important, and probably, unfortunately, it's impossible to do all of them. I think the one really important thing is to set boundaries. Very often, to get to where we are, you have made sacrifices and afraid to say no. So you've done things even though you may not have had the bandwidth. And that gets harder as time goes on, especially when you start to introduce family. So setting those boundaries early of, you know, when you can say no and how to say no, those are important things to practice. The other thing I tell all of our fellows, like when they graduate and our young partners, when we hire them, is I say, look, like when you have kids, I want you to get their class schedule for the year. I want you to give it to your scheduler. And I want you to block out those days where they have off or, you know, administrative days at school or late start so you can stay at home and have breakfast and take them to school. And, you know, when they have plays and things like that, make the time, because seeing three more patients or doing one more surgery means absolutely nothing to your kids. And it's not going to make you a happier individual. It's hard, though, because very frequently people are building their practice, which they've worked their whole life to do, at the same time they're raising a family. And when the kids are older, it's easier to work later and stay late. But when the kids are younger, I think it's so important to block out those times at work that it kind of coincides with when the kids are off of school. The other thing I'm hoping is going to be better, I find that the younger generation now definitely has a better way of sort of turning off work, where with the 80-hour work week, you know, it was, hey, I worked, I've done my 24 hours, here's my sign out, I'm done. And I think in my generation and older generations, it just never ended. You just worked and worked and worked and worked and worked. So I think it's a very healthy boundary to say, I'm done, I'm leaving. But we're so still connected. Very frequently, I talk to so many people that are like, yeah, I check my in-basket on Saturdays and Sundays. And it's just like, we're so ingrained with checking our email and checking our text and checking, you know, the in-basket, that there has to be a way for people to say, hey, I'm not going to do it. I try never to check it on the weekends anymore. Like if I had a patient maybe on Friday that had a pressing lab that I wanted to know what the result is, so I didn't have to act on it over the weekend, I might wait and check that result. But I really try to make it a habit to not check email, because frequently I would check on the weekends and it'd be something that was sort of mundane, but it would be enough to stir my brain and piss me off. And then it just made me feel terrible for the whole weekend. And I wasn't going to address it until Monday anyway. So I just found for me, that was a healthy boundary. And the other thing that I haven't heard too many people talk about it, but I have seen it in certain instances. And I think it might be a future where we might see more paired practices. So you and I become doctors together. You have to find sort of doctors that are similar in mindset and how they treat their patients. But, you know, one of us works 3 days a week, one of us works 2 days a week. You're off for a week, I cover the whole week. You're off for a week, I, you know, and vice versa. So the patients have continuity of care. They might see me or you. And I think if you're working those shorter days, you're probably more productive on those days. You might actually stay later. So you might actually wind up generating more RVUs and having more patient care visits. And it's kind of like you talked about in your video of like, this is going to be making a little less money. Sure, you might be making a little less income, but do you last longer? Are you happier for longer? Can you kind of make a long 30-year career in that format versus being the sole person? Because I think the idea of nurse practitioners and PAs is great too, but again, trying to find one that aligns with how you treat patients And it becomes an investment. More often than not, I hear doctors that spend a year or two training a nurse practitioner, PA, and then they leave, and it becomes a huge burden to then train another one and train another one. So if you have someone that stays, that's great. But I think you're going to see a lot more physicians start to do sort of these paired models where it becomes less of a burden and they're almost working sort of a part-time job, which, you know, part-time job in our world is still full-time. There was an article I read the other day that said average physician still works 70 hours a week. So if you're working 35 hours a week, I would still say that's a full-time job. But I think it would be healthier mentally and physically, you know, if people weren't stretched so thin for so many years.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Rosen, thank you for being so open and for being so candid and for documenting your story in such a vivid and thoughtful way. You know, what's next for you and how can our listeners get involved or support your work?
So what's next? I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. I keep evolving over these past couple of years. I've really enjoyed making YouTube content for patients. I've gotten incredible responses from people all over the world, which is not what I expected. And what I find is, you know, we all have good days and bad days. So with the YouTube channel, it's nice because I can make my content on my time. When I want to do it, when I feel that I'm able to do it, and then I can kind of put it out there and share it with people. I found that I really enjoyed writing. So I have some other ideas of other books that I want to write, more sort of in the fiction realm. Mm-hmm. So now it's just a matter of trying to find the time to do that. But I've kind of enjoyed, I was very nervous in the beginning of talking about sort of my mental health journey and things that I learned along the way. And what I found is each time I talk about it, it gets easier and easier. So I have a couple more lectures that I was asked to give to different doctors groups. And that for me has been, you know, really rewarding to be able to share my experience in more of a kind of personal, intimate sort of setting. And then having people come up and again, you know, ask questions and share their stories and sort of their struggles and how my story kind of resonated with what they've been through or what they're going through currently. So that's kind of the plan for now, but just kind of waiting to see, you know, what happens. But I want to thank you for having me and letting me talk. So it was great to meet you and be able to tell my story.
Yeah, Dr. Rosen, it was great. Keep doing what you're doing. You're a force for change and a beacon of hope. And it was great to have you on the show.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Have a good day.